Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen. All right, we continue our study of the history of Vatican II using tumultuous times as our text. And you'll be glad to notice, I'm sure, at the top of the page where we have the link to all the talks audio recordings and study sheets. It's a much shorter, much easier to remember link than the one I put last Sunday in the bulletin. You couldn't make it work. You know, if it's off by just one letter, one tiny thing, you can't open it. But this works. I've tested it over and over again. Basically, it's at tinyurl.com, and then I could put in our own little custom name, Tumult Times. So this will work. You can, it's all downloadable for anybody that wants to do it. So our topic for tonight is on John the 23rd, and before I go any further with that, I want to also mention today is the Feast of Our Lady of La Salette. And the secret of Our Lady of La Salette was apparently never intended to be revealed to everybody, as opposed to the third secret of Fatima, which was supposed to be revealed to everybody and never was. But Our Lady appeared only one time at La Salette to the two shepherds, Melanie and Maximin. She was weeping bitterly over the sins of men. And she did obviously ask for repentance. I mean, we know it's recorded the part that, you know, some of Our Lady's words, and Our Lady was lamenting the sins of mankind and asking people to, you know, turn back to God. And but then she also entrusted a secret to each of them, and those were to be given to Pope Pius IX. He did, in fact, read them. And he was a pope who suffered very, very much. He might as well have been a martyr, in my opinion, how much he had to suffer because all the revolutions, the anti-Catholicism, the hatred of the church, the toppling of one Catholic monarchy after another in the 19th century. It was a terrible time. Very aptly named, tumultuous times. The church has been through one tumult over another, but that's a proof of the church's divine core, you might say. No human institution could survive. But something that's divinely founded and is guaranteed to last until the end of time will survive. So one thing I did mention, this was the day before the eclipse, remember? The August 21st eclipse. Did anybody get to see the full eclipse traveling 100 miles south of Spokane? 95%? Okay. I thought it was about 95% here in Spokane, and I knew that was going to happen, so I talked about the eclipse message of Our Lady of La Salette. And something that Melanie did say, this is not part of the secret, is that the church will go into eclipse. It will be very hard to find where the church is. Are we seeing that now? Absolutely. So many times people have said when they finally found a place like Mount St. Michael or some other traditional Catholic Mass location, they said, I never even knew that you existed. I didn't know what to do. And to me, that is the literal fulfillment of that prophecy of the church being in eclipse and hard to find. But it's not impossible. People do find it. They may have to really search and struggle for a long time, but they will find the truth. They will find the faith. So anyway, let's go on to our topic for today, which is about the one who convoked Vatican Council II. I hope you have the study sheets distributed. Are there any extras around in case some that just came in might want a copy? Any extra copies around? I printed off 40. Hope that was about enough. Okay, so if anybody wants to get a, if you can just kind of spread those around, that would be great. Okay, so we're talking about John the 23rd, and I hesitate to say Pope. because I'm going to give you many reasons tonight that make me really wonder if he had the Catholic faith. He was absolutely an adherent of modernism. And Pope St. Pius X declared that modernism was the synthesis of all heresies. So beginning with John the 23rd, even though you could have a debate on his status as Pope, at least from Paul the 6th on, no doubt that these could not possibly be the true vicar of Christ on earth because of what they taught, what they promulgated, and their own personal expression of what they believed. It's not the same Catholic faith that you and I have. So what I wanted to begin is something that's not in the book per se. Well, it is a little bit, if you want to follow a little bit in the book, there's on page 501, there are a couple of pages that talk about the Third Fatima Secret, but I want to give this from a different angle. And I'll begin with this. If he was a true pope, he refused to reveal the third secret of Fatima. And here are the facts. So let's just look at our study outline. Now, around 1943, Sister Lucia, the only living member of the three Fatima children, had gotten very ill. And the worry was that she would die not having revealed the third Fatima secret. And so her bishop, the bishop of Leiria, commanded her, and she said, "Your Excellency, that's the only way I can reveal the secret right now, only if you command me." And the bishop thought about it for a while, and then for a few days or weeks, and then he said, "Yes, I do command you." And then when it was given to him in a sealed envelope, he didn't want to open it. And I can guess the reasons why. You know, here's this secret that talks about the future of the world and what's going to happen. You can imagine the human fear the bishop would have had. I have the secret. If Sister Lucia dies, at least it won't die with her. But I don't know if I want the weight of that responsibility on me. And so the bishop kept it. And then in 1957, a command came from Rome, from the Holy Office. It is to be delivered to Rome. So it was sent by, I believe, an auxiliary bishop. It was brought to Rome, very strictly guarded, you know, very well safeguarded. But then it seems that Pope Pius XII didn't want to open it either. And it seems that he was waiting for 1960, but then he died October 9th of 1958. So Sister Lucia had said that the letter was to be open and read to the world upon her death or by 1960, whichever would happen first. Sister Lucia had said, quote, "The Blessed Virgin wishes it so, and also that it would be clearer at that time." And by the way, I'm not speaking in my own authority. There have been many writings about the Third Fatima Secret. If I could just hold up to you this third three-volume series, The Whole Truth About Fatima. This is all about the Third Secret of Fatima by a certain Frère Michel of the Holy Trinity. So this religious brother has been able to do this tremendous amount of research. And obviously there's a lot of guesswork, but there's educated guesswork on what does that Third Fatima Secret contain, because it was not revealed in 1960. So I'm drawing on his research. Here's a much shorter version of just so when you don't have time to go through this, you go through the shorter version. Okay. So John the 23rd secretary, Monsignor Capovia, stated that John the 23rd read the secret in August 1959. He didn't want to read it right away. He wanted to read it with his confessor. Fair enough. You know, it's a very weighty thing to open the third secret of Fatima and see what it's going to tell about the future of the world about to happen. And then we know also that a Portuguese translator was asked to come in. I believe that he was reading this at Castel Gandolfo, which is the summer getaway for the Pope, some distance from Rome. And so the one of the Portuguese priests that worked in the Vatican bureaucracy was called over there, help with some of the translating some of the words or phrases. And then Monsignor Capovia says that Cardinal Ottaviani also saw that third secret of Fatima. 1959. And then after that, it was buried. On February 8, 1960, an anonymously written Vatican communique said that the secret would not be revealed and ended with, "Although the Church recognizes the Fatima apparitions, she does not desire to take the responsibility of guaranteeing the veracity of the words that the three shepherd children said that the Virgin Mary had addressed to them." So, no name. Actually, we do know, and I think this is quoted in Tumultuous Times, John the 23rd said, "It doesn't concern my pontificate." But what a huge problem. The Church had already approved, released the first two parts of the secret. One of them was the vision of hell. The other one was World War II happening and Russia spreading her errors through the world. That's the gist of the second part. So if the Church allowed that to be published, why wouldn't the Church publish now the third Fatima secret that was supposed to be revealed in 1960? No real reason was given other than, well, we don't want to vouch for it. Well, then we have all this guesswork. What was in there? And I think the best explanation is that there would be a great falling away of Catholics. In other words, this was going to be consistent with the message of La Salette. But what had what happened on January 25th of 1959, a year and a half before, John the 23rd said, "I'm going to call a council." And I think he read the condemnation of his council in the third secret of Fatima, and that's why he didn't reveal it. I'm convinced of it. I don't think there's any other plausible explanation. If there is another plausible explanation, let's hear it. Why would he not have revealed it? So that... it has to do with a great loss of faith, and that's what happened. But you see, if he had revealed this, it would have condemned his pet project. But being the modernist that he was, he believed in his modernism more than he believed in Our Lady, and he put his heresy ahead of Our Lady. I don't think that's unfair to say that at all. He put his modernism ahead of Our Lady. So, and what did we read at his on his opening address? It's about a four or five page address to the cardinals and bishops. Look what he says: "We feel we must disagree with those prophets of gloom who are always forecasting disaster as though the end of the world were at hand." So, to me, that's just disparaging what I think the third secret of Fatima is. It is a message about bad things are going to happen. I mean, the vision of hell, is that gloom? Yeah? What about Russia's, what about World War II and Russia spreading her errors throughout the world? That's a gloomy prophecy, but it's only given so people will change their lives. Then the bad things don't have to happen, you see. So if it had been revealed in 1960 that many Catholics would lose the faith, as has happened, it would have prevented that from happening. But you see, a modernist will not even listen to the message of heaven. And yes, I know he's already canonized. He's Saint John the 23rd in the Vatican II Church. How can you be a saint and defy Our Lady like this? So anyway, I think it was very important we started off with the secret of Fatima. So let's start going through the biographical facts here of his life. He was born in 1881, ordained a priest in 1904, worked in the Diocese of Bergamo, Italy. In 1925, he was ordained titular bishop and was assigned diplomatic posts. He was an official to Bulgaria, then apostolic delegate to Bulgaria. In other words, he went up from just a visitor to the official representative of the Catholic Church to the government of Bulgaria, then apostolic delegate to Turkey and Greece, and then he was made apostolic nuncio to France in 1944. And we'll go into the reasons why that happened. In 1953, he was made cardinal and appointed Patriarch of Venice, Italy. What other famous cardinal was the Patriarch of Venice? Pope St. Pius the 10th. So that was the diocese of the anti-modernist, and now in 1953 they were going to get a modernist. And I would say probably not one of the better decisions of Pope Pius XII when he made these. You see, Pope Pius XII became pope in 1939, so the nuncio to France, being made cardinal, Patriarch of Venice, Pope Pius XII's decisions. Probably not his best advised ones. Okay, so in October 28th, after 11 ballots, he was elected pope, and I was reading somewhere that after he was elected, he pulled out his acceptance speech. So he had it ready. Oh, I can be pope. So, okay. And then he had only a short pontificate, if it was a true one, debatable, as I've said already. And then he died June 3rd, 1963, and then Montini took over, and then the sledgehammer really started being taken to the church, because Paul VI was radical. What he brought about was just absolutely radical. He signed all 16 documents of Vatican Council II. He approved all the rewritings of the Mass, the sacraments, everything. I mean, and he was the ecumenist the most forward ecumenist, you might say, at the time. So, all right, so let's look now at the problems before papal election. And here we look at our book on page 295. At the bottom of the page there, I want to tell you about one of his good friends, Ernesto Buonaiuti. I think I'm pronouncing that okay in Italian. Buonaiuti, who assisted at Roncalli's first Mass, was a suspected modernist who was excommunicated in 1924, and then declared vitandus excommunicated, which means the Pope personally expelled him from the Church. Now, Buonaiuti, why does this matter? Well, there's that saying, tell me who your friends are and I'll tell you who you are. I mean, you can tell a lot about a person by who you associate with. This Buonaiuti, when the encyclical on modernism came out by Pope Pius X, he wrote he basically wrote a response trying to refute Pope St. Pius X. I found a digitized book on Google called The Program of Modernism, and there he is, Ernesto Buonaiuti. And let me just read to you a little bit of what basically he was shocked by Pope St. Pius X's encyclical, which came out September 7th, 1907. And he said, we have to defend ourselves. You've condemned us. Now, what problem do you have if you think you're going to refute a pope's official teaching? What's your problem? What's at a very basic level? P-R-I-D-E. He was refusing to accept Pope St. Pius. Well, he wasn't canonized then, but he was refusing to accept his encyclical on modernism. I just... I want to read just a little bit here to you. You can get the flavor of it. Okay. Now, listen. I mean, he's going to sound like a Protestant here. Okay. And by the way, 1907, when was John the 23rd ordained a priest? 1904. So we're talking about 3 years after John the 23rd was ordained a priest. This is 4 years after he had been a priest. And already he is going to refute the Pope. Listen to these words. A document so weighty, both in substance and form, as the encyclical which we have reproduced at the end of this book, an attempt to deliberate, to present modernist views to the public under a false and unfavorable light. Those are his opening words. Pius X, you have put modernism in a false and unfavorable light. What priest should dare think of even saying that to a pope? A condemnation so authoritative of us modernists as dangerous foes of Christian piety and unconscious promoters of atheism make it a duty which we own to our own conscience, to the collective conscience of the faithful, and to an anxious and expectant public to lay bare our whole mind without reserve or concealment. We cannot possibly remain silent under the violent accusation which the chief authority of the Church, albeit recognizing us as her faithful subjects and has resolved to cling to her till our last breath, heaps upon our head. Who does this remind you of, those of you that are familiar with your Catholic history? Martin Luther. What are Martin Luther's famous words when he said, I'm going to refute that pope that just condemned me? What are his famous words? Here I stand. Here I stand, and I am going to defy you. So basically, this good friend of John the 23rd was openly and publicly defying Pope St. Pius X. Who's the infallible one? Is it the priest? Or is it the true pope? Yes, it's the true pope. But he sounds absolutely like Martin Luther. He's still wet behind the ears, so to speak. You know, that expression. You know, he's not... You know, and he's just, without any reserve, he's just protesting to Pope St. Pius X, his encyclical on modernism. So that's Buonaiuti. Now, notice he wasn't even excommunicated right away. That shows how the Church was trying to be lenient with him. By the way, when Martin Luther was excommunicated, it was after years of the Pope trying to reach him, trying to say, look, come on, let's get this worked out. Come to Rome. The Church was not acting high-handedly. The Church was trying to deal with him and try to bring him back to the truth. But, you know, pride gets in the way, and you have people like this. So anyway, number three, he was secretary to the modernist-leaning bishop of Bergamo. And our book here says that he was basically assigned to a smaller diocese. When bishops were somewhat suspected as not being entirely solid, they were not given main dioceses or very leading positions. They were kind of put into obscure locations, and then still they would keep an eye on them. Well, that was basically the situation with his bishop, and then his bishop makes him his secretary. Okay, so you can read on page 296 there the left leaning, you might say, about Bishop Radini Tedeschi. And then we read that when he's a priest, Father Angelo Roncalli seems to favor socialism. He seems to favor the left leaning side of things, so to speak, versus the conservative side. Okay, and then on page 294, we read here in a letter to Roncalli written by a cardinal who spoke with him, and he wrote to him, "According to information that has come my way, I knew that you had been a reader of Duquesne, whose book, History of the Early Church, had been placed on the Index of Forbidden Books and used in Roncalli Seminary lectures and other unbridled authors, and that on certain occasions you had shown yourself inclined to that school of thought which tends to empty out the value of tradition and the authority of the past, a dangerous current which leads to fatal consequences." So this cardinal's writing in a charitable spirit. He says, you know, my dear Father Roncalli, first of all, you're using condemned books. When you're teaching in the seminary, he was given teaching assignments in the Diocese of Bergamo. Get away from there. This is going to cause you, I mean, he should have said it, but he says you're already disobeying the church by using condemned resources. Okay, so anyway, that is the situation there, okay? And then we know that basically from this time on that Father Roncalli was being watched. Now, it's kind of a mystery here. If he's being watched, if he's being suspected of modernism, why is he now being assigned to diplomatic posts? Somewhat of a mystery, but I think sometimes, you know, people can be aware of a problem and not deal with it very effectively. Or maybe they consider these diplomatic posts to be just to obscure areas. For example, going to Bulgaria, which had a strong Orthodox or schismatic Orthodox presence, maybe it was not considered a strong Catholic country, so he would be considered not a real problem if he went there. And then he was sent to Greece and Turkey. What was the Catholic population of Greece and Turkey at that time? I mean, Turkey, what was the predominant religion in Turkey? Islam. And then what was the predominant religion in Greece? Greek schismatics. There's very few Catholics, relatively speaking, in Greece and Turkey. So maybe that explains it. It was seen as, well, these are not important posts, few Catholics, we'll just leave them there, hope it won't cause a lot of harm. Okay, but then we see that he was made, and now this is a high position, and again, maybe not one of the better decisions of Pope Pius XII. On December 22, 1944, Archbishop Roncalli was nominated Apostolic Nuncio to France. So that was a big step up, because France was considered a Catholic country. These were not Catholic countries. Now, let's read here how to explain this. Why did Pope Pius XII give him that position and make him a cardinal? Actually, the cardinal came later. The appointment as papal nuncio to Paris meant that Roncalli certainly would later become a cardinal and enter that select group eligible to be elected pope. It was by default rather than by choice that Roncalli got this appointment. The two worthy men chosen by Pope Pius XII, Archbishops Valerio Valeri and Giuseppe Fiera of Buenos Aires, were rejected by French President Charles de Gaulle. I think that's the way to pronounce his name, Charles de Gaulle. And now remember, this is 1 year before the end of World War II. Some of the worst fighting was happening here. As a matter of fact, right at this time, what famous battle was going on during World War II in France? Battle of the Bulge. And the Germans had broken out. And there was a huge bulge where they were reaching into Allied territory, and Hitler saw that as a real possibility of breaking out and basically destroying the Allied occupation of Europe. So some of the fiercest fighting happened during that time. One of the smaller battles within that, this is just a little historical tidbit, you you probably have read about it, but the Battle of Bastogne, and the Germans had surrounded this town, and they sent in to the American officer, or the colonel that was in charge, he says, "You better surrender, otherwise we're going to blow you to bits." And he was really, this was General Terry McAuliffe. And he was so mad, he didn't want to give in to the Germans at all, and he said, "Nuts." And then one of his subordinate officers says, "Why don't you send that message back to the Germans?" And so he did. So the Germans got back this message, "Nuts." They said, what's nuts? Basically, our American, actually he was probably a general. He said, "We're not surrendering to you. That's crazy." And they held out, and they held Bastogne, and that helped eventually to win the Battle of the Bulge. And then they continued, you know, with their invasion of Germany. So the war had to come to an end, and it had to come through total victory. So anyway, so this is a very, very stressful time going on. Also, the Germans, I think, were still occupying Rome, or either that or they had recently left. So, I mean, it's a very, very traumatic time for everybody going on. So this was the historical circumstances. He was appointed apostolic nuncio, and Pius XII wanted two others, and the Charles de Gaulle, who was in charge of the resistance against the Germans, didn't want to have anything to do with those two. So apparently, Pope Pius XII, by sending a second-class type of diplomat, was kind of saying, "Okay, you don't want my two choices, I'll give you Roncalli." So that's one theory. Okay. So we know that, so to sum up what we've said so far, we know that Father Angelo Roncalli associated very freely with modernists. There were others. For another one was Dom Baudouin, I think is a French or Belgian name. He was a modernist that was very much involved in the liturgy. So birds of a feather flock together. Buonaiuti, who was excommunicated, who defied Pope Pius the X. So we know that he's dealing with these types of people. He's being assigned unimportant posts. And then he takes this post in France. So we know that so far. Okay, his socialism. Let's read about that from our book here. As Apostolic Nuncio of France, Roncalli strongly supported the communist worker-priest movement, which placed priests as ordinary laborers in factories, so they could more easily approach the working class. This was not a good idea. Basically, what happened is priests found themselves among the common laborers. Now, when that happens because they're all thrown into a concentration camp, obviously nobody can control that. But it's not a good idea to have clergy and laity, you know, just live together on a constant basis and constantly interact as though they're all the same. And this is what happened with the worker priest movement, and he was in favor of it. And they ended up, these worker priests, instead of being true priests and focusing on the spiritual, they're working in the factories, working in the coal mines, working among the, you know, nothing wrong with the dignity of labor, but that's not their place. Where do priests belong? Doing the spiritual fatherhood work that only they can do. That's their purpose in life, not just to be among the masses working in their daily occupations as well. So let's read to top of page 299. The worker priest movement began during World War II. In 1942, the Nazis deported 800,000 Frenchmen to slave labor camps and refused to allow French priests to attend to their spiritual needs. Cardinal Suhard, Archbishop of Paris, secretly smuggled 25 young priests among the prisoners. Okay, that would not be a problem. Just to go in there to do the spiritual work. What's 25 priests among 800,000? But the problem came in after the war. After the war, a number of these priests petitioned the archbishop to remain worker priests and to live in close proximity with the laity. To the Vatican, this was an innovation that could only result in scandal. Many of the priests were discovered and repatriated, who died in the camps. And then Thomas Cahill describes the many dangers. Well, I basically described it already. You can read it there on your own. You know, not to lose their priestly identity, but that's what was happening. And then, when you start joining communist groups, you know this whole thing has gone completely wrong. So, realizing that the worker priests were joining communist-controlled unions and persuading factory workers to accept Marxism, the Dominican and Jesuit superiors in 1954 finally forbade their priests to engage in this activity. Most priests went back to their parishes, while others left the priesthood and got married. Obviously, a very bad thing. They went back on their priestly vows, and that was obviously a great sin on their part, and it also excommunicated them, made them irregular. Not supposed to happen. But this was something that he didn't really have a problem with, and he was supporting. So this is kind of that idea of socialism is a good thing. And if I may say, well, right now, what countries are suffering terribly from socialism, if not outright communism? You read about Venezuela, how bad things are there. I mean, the people don't have food to eat. It's terrible because basically the government has taken over all the businesses, all the major businesses. And there's violence and rioting almost on a weekly, maybe even daily basis. People are suffering under socialism. They're one degree away from totalitarianism where, there's absolutely no freedom, where you dissent and you get shot, or you get sent to prison. So things are very bad there. And the government should not take over the businesses because, first of all, the government, once it takes over all the businesses, does it have a competitor anymore? No. And then you get service goes down, and prices go up. It always happens when the government becomes the business operator. Having the government stay out of business ownership is one of the greatest aspects of freedom. It should only step in if there's a real necessity. But anyway, Venezuela's suffering. Now, Cuba is either totally socialist or communist. I mean, I would say it's still probably more on the side of communism, although you can visit it now. There used to be an embargo. So the Catholic Church has condemned socialism, condemned communism, because they violate people's freedoms. And it makes the whole country suffer terribly. But, of course, Pope Francis, Bergoglio, he preaches socialism all the time. He's a socialist. He's made it very clear that that's where he stands. By the way, that's where Obama stood. He said, when he got elected in 2008, remember he talked about fundamentally transforming the United States as though he had the right to do that? No, we should go by the Constitution. But anyway, we'll let that one go. Okay. So anyway, he definitely favored socialism. Okay, now let's talk about the 1958 conclave. And so we're now on letter D of our outline. We're on page 300 of the book. And you probably have heard about this, the Cardinal Siri theory. Who's heard of it? Okay. This is how the Cardinal Siri theory goes, that this conservative cardinal from Genoa, he was the Archbishop of the Diocese of Genoa, that he was really elected, and then the modernists, the real evildoers among the cardinals, they were in the minority, they came together and they said, either Cardinal Siri, you resign, or we're going to do something so catastrophic that the whole world will suffer. Maybe we'll bring about nuclear war, or we'll cause some unbelievably terrible thing to happen. So under duress, Cardinal Siri says, all right, I won't accept the election. And then John the 23rd was elected. And then supposedly the same scenario happened in 1963. Personally, I don't believe it. There's too many problems with a theory like that. And what refutes it most of all is the fact that Cardinal Siri acknowledged John the 23rd as the Pope. He acknowledged Paul the 6th as the Pope. So when he's doing that publicly, what is that saying? So if he ever had that claim, he's publicly renouncing it by acknowledging them as popes. Does that make sense? Okay. I mean, there are some people that are still diehard Siri theory or Siri thesis adherents, and they think that, you know, that it's true. But you know, Cardinal Siri died 25 years ago. So what good does that do the church? It doesn't do the church any good. All right. So as I said, we're reading at the top of page 301. I'll skip the part about the two false alarms. You know, there was supposedly gray smoke going up, black smoke, until the white smoke. You all understand that, how that works. Okay, there, you know, whenever a pope is being elected, there's probably hundreds of thousands of people waiting in St. Peter's Square. Maybe not right away, but they give it a day or two to see who the next pope is. And then there's this very solemn pronouncement by the cardinal proto-deacon. In other words, the number one cardinal deacon who makes the announcement to everybody, Habemus Papam, which is, we have a pope. And then he announces who the name is, and everybody claps and cheers. But anyway, they're all waiting to see the smoke coming out of the chimney of the Sistine Chapel where the elections take place. And when a ballot, I think they can only do two ballots in the morning, two ballots in the afternoon. So that's four ballots a day. And they have to, you know, carefully count up all of the ballots, you know, make sure that the right number is there, and then unfold them carefully, you know, write down the results. And so the 11th ballot, so what? How many days was that, that John the 23rd would have been on the, what, fourth day? So you got four, on the, okay, towards the end of the third day. And whenever the ballots are not, you have to be elected pope by 2/3. It can't just be anything over 50%. It has to be 2/3 plus one to make absolutely sure. So until that 2/3 is reached, they burn all of the paper ballots and they put in some wet straw so make sure black smoke comes out. And because the white smoke came out first, and then the black, and then kind of a grayish, some people say, ah, see, the Siri theory is true. Cardinal Siri was elected, he accepted, and then he was blackmailed into not accepting the papacy, so he had to resign, and then they did another election. You know, mistakes can happen. I don't think we should put too much stock in the color. You know, things can go wrong. Sometimes something else can get inside the stove and make the smoke look black. But they try to make sure that this does mistake or this problem doesn't happen in future papal elections. So anyway, it's waiting for the white smoke, and then they know a pope has been elected. So all right. So he says, I will be called John. John. The electors who knew their history were confounded. The last John the 23rd had been an anti-pope, a former pirate, and murderer. As with the name Henry in the British royal family, the last bearer of the name was thought to have rendered it unusable. What was he thinking of by using John? There's no law that says he couldn't do it, but sometimes, you know, when there's a lot of, you know, taint on a name, they just pick something else. But he made it clear he wanted to take the name of John the 23rd, who was definitely an anti-pope. And he wasn't an anti-pope because he was a heretic. He was an anti-pope because he was improperly elected. So what page was our... See, we have it in here. And let's take a quick look at the list of all the anti-popes. Does anybody have that handy, what page that is? It's great to look at. Okay, I think I found it already. Okay, page 592. Okay, we see the list of 41 anti-popes. Anybody can look up the lives of any one of them. And none of them were true popes to begin with because of a problem in the election. Okay, it wasn't because they were true popes and fell into heresy. It just didn't happen. There was legality problems. And this is why, this is an aside note, but this is why voter registration is a very weighty thing. Because if you have people that are not citizens voting in an election, what's the problem with that election? It throws the whole election into question. You have to have valid electors for anything. And we're having problems right now in our country because some states have very loose requirements. I was reading something about New Hampshire that in this last election cycle that you could register to vote on the day of election, no waiting period, in New Hampshire and become a registered voter that day because you just moved to the state that day. And then the Democrats won that vote by like 1,300 votes, won the state. I think there should be stringent enough requirements for voters to make sure that these are citizens. You know, if you're not a citizen, you can't vote, period. So anyway, not to get into politics too much. Okay, back to John the 23rd here being elected. Okay, we are on page. Please help me out. I lost my page. 301. Okay, thank you. A lot of pages here in this book. Okay. So, anyway, he decided to go with John the 23rd. By the way, John the 22nd was a true pope. By the way, it was to Pope John the 22nd that Our Lady appeared and gave him the Sabbatine. The Sabbatine privilege promise that those who observe chastity according to their state of life and say the office of Our Lady or fast or abstain from meat on Wednesdays and Saturdays or in our case, our modern day case, pray the rosary daily that they could be taken out of purgatory the first Saturday after their death. So that was Pope John the 22nd. But anyway, he chose John the 23rd. Okay. So we wonder why he took the name of such a scandalous character. I think one of the reasons John the 23rd gave, he said, all of the Pope Johns had a short pontificate. So I don't know, maybe he was expecting to have only a short pontificate, and he did, only 5 years. He was 77 years of age. So maybe he wasn't expecting to live long. I don't know. But within 3 months of being elected, he gets this flash of brilliance. I'm going to call a council of the church. Okay. So one of the first things he does as Pope, he goes over to the Holy Office to check out his file. And what does he find on his file? suspected of modernism. And he was, you know, things had gotten to the point where he could say, oh, that's just, you know, that's just the way they were. They were just kind of worried about nothing there. Well, I think it was really something. So once elected, he found his file in the Holy Office marked under suspicion of modernism. His modernism was proved by his aggiornamento. Here indeed was a revolution, as the historian E. Hales wrote in his book, Pope John and His Revolution. I think even somebody like him could recognize what a dramatic change was about to happen, you know, from the conservative, traditional, to something new. On January 25th, 1959, he decided to convoke an ecumenical council, allowing the schema. We talked about this last Tuesday. This was all of the well-planned out, well-researched, proposed programs of discussion. Many of them were prepared by conservative cardinals and bishops. Just before Vatican Council II begins, he scraps them all. I mean, just from a human point of view, how would you feel if you were asked to prepare this, you know, this program, and then after almost 4 years of work, you're told, "Oh, we're gonna use a different approach now." I mean, what a slap in the face! But so people say, how do we know he was a true pope or not? Well, I know for a fact, and this is not an opinion, this is a fact, that he scrapped the conservative agenda or schema, and he listened to the modernists. They got their way. He let them put the agenda on the table. He let them prepare the programs, the new schemas. He didn't give the conservatives a chance. And that's why I have huge problems calling him Pope John the 23rd. I know he was a modernist. We know what he was doing, and there's a lot more that's been written about him, but we only have time to look at one class. And you know, the very fact that he disregarded Our Lady, that he said we have to look forward to an exciting new time. Things are going to be great. Don't be gloomy. And of course, he makes Time Magazine Man of the Year. That's a problem, because our Lord says, if you follow me, you will, you know, I'm paraphrasing our Lord, expect to be persecuted like me. But he was very popular. The press loved him. Everybody called him Good Pope John. But the conservatives were really worried about what he was doing and the direction he was taking things. So I couldn't find whether for sure he said this, but you read that he said, I want to open the windows of the church and let in the fresh air. His encyclicals, if not overtly heretical, definitely had a modernist flavor. And his ecumenism was plain for everyone to see. In 1960, he established the Secretariat for Christian Unity, made several overtures to non-Catholic religions, and even is on the Lutheran calendar of saints. And Father documents that. I would be really worried about any priest, anybody that makes it on the Lutheran calendar of saints. And one last thing to read, and we're going to have to stop here in 1 minute. I was just reading from his opening speech it's like I said, a 4 or 5 page document that he's talking to all the cardinals and bishops, and already said, don't listen to anything gloomy. And then he says what really contradicts what the church has said before. He says, unfortunately, the entire Christian family has not yet fully attained this visible unity and truth. Okay, and that's a very loaded statement right there, because what he's saying, let me read it to you again, and then I'll tell you what it means, or tell you what it's loaded with. The entire Christian family has not yet fully attained this visible unity and truth. So he's saying all the Protestants are part of the Christian family. And he's denying that the true unity already exists in the Catholic Church. So right there with one sentence, he was definitely promoting what was going to be the cardinal sin of Vatican II, ecumenism. We're going to start acknowledging all the other religions, and that's when you end up losing your own. So we'll have to leave it at that. So, yes. The question is, what was the problem with the anti-popes? It was an electoral problem. How did they get rid of anti-popes? Sometimes the military people came in and removed them from the Vatican or from the Lateran Palace. That happened a number of times. So,